I'm Jen White. This is 1A. While the majority of Americans know that Joe Biden won the 2020 election, Pew Research found this month that 64% of Republicans believe incorrectly that Donald Trump won instead. There's no evidence showing widespread fraud, and the election results have been upheld again and again by Republican election officials across the country. So why do so many people still believe it? Well, before we ask the experts, we wanted to hear from someone who has believed in conspiracy theories. One listener called us from Utah with his story about realizing that some things he believed in may not be true. So this morning, we called him back.
Hello.
Hi, this is Jen White. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Sure, no problem.
So you said that you used to believe in some conspiracies after 9/11. What changed for you?
Mainly, it was just some soul searching. I noticed that I was not very happy. I was scared a lot of the time. It was definitely making me depressed. I was, trying to find more and more information. And I just needed a change, to be honest.
How did you get out of the mindset of being consumed by these things?
I've been trying to figure that out myself. I think the main thing I did is I just decided to try to control what I could control, control things in front of me. I just started applying myself more in my community, and that actually made me feel better, got me out of the depression, and I guess control what I can control.
You told us your parents recently started believing in some conspiracies, too. Tell us about that.
They did, and it was a surprise. Right after the Capitol riots, essentially, we finally started talking again. We hadn't talked in a while. And my mother told me that she believed it was liberals dressed up as Trump supporters who had stormed the Capitol to make Trump look bad. And that was so mind-blowing to me. I didn't know my mom, who's just like a suburban Texas woman, could get there in her head. So I was very surprised by it.
So the conversation with your parents about what happened at the Capitol started around a photo your father found of the insurrection. What happened from there?
Yeah, so I get this random text from my dad, who I don't hear from him too regularly, and it's a photograph of a man at the riot who kind of looks like me. He's got a beard, he's holding a camera, and just said, "Oh, it looks like you came over to the dark side." That was the caption my dad sent with it, and I really didn't know how to take it, but I saw it as an opportunity to finally have a conversation. We've had a lot of tainted relationship moments through Christmas and Thanksgiving. Over the past 4 years, it's been really hard. And I just decided that this was not going to be one of those times where I was going to try to come with facts and I was going to come tell him that his side was wrong. I just decided to, address the situation by asking him what he actually believes in. And what I found out is, we're lined up maybe 70% on what we believe in. There are very weird fringe things that we don't agree with. For instance, my dad does not believe in climate change. My mom believes in QAnon stuff. But it's easier to push those ideas to the fringe when we know that the meat and potatoes of what we all believe in is roughly the same.
When you think about the challenges you've had in your relationship with your parents over the past year or so, and you think about the times when you were in conspiratorial thinking, does it make you think about maybe the way your relationships were tested or strained?
I think the big difference is that all the conspiracies that I believed in never made me go align myself with a hate group or a white supremacist group or violent people. If I was thinking about 9/11 conspiracies, I was not dressing up in tactical gear and trying to hurt people. So I don't feel like it's the same. It doesn't mean that there's not, a version of my own crazy, but that's why I have a hard time with where my parents are at. They're good people. I don't think they're racist people, but the fact that they can align themselves with these other groups and not want to push them away, that's where I have a really hard time with it.
So for that 30% that you don't agree on, do you feel compelled to lean into that 30%, or is it more, that's a minefield, we're not going to talk about that?
So, we've only really started talking about this since the Capitol riot. you know, my dad will send me an article from Tucker Carlson, some video of him talking. And before, I would have just totally thrown that out. I have my own, you know, ideas of who Tucker Carlson is and what he's trying to do. So before, I would be like, okay, yeah, whatever. I'm not going to watch that. Now I'm really trying to watch it and think critically through it and be like, what is my dad trying to tell me through this video? What is really the issue at hand that he's trying to show me? So I want to have the conversations. I think when we keep talking about it, we'll figure all this stuff out.
Is there, I guess, a threshold for you for how far you're willing to push, how far you're willing to go with this, where you say, I can't, you just get to a point where like, I cannot do this. I cannot have these conversations anymore, with the understanding that these are your parents.
Yeah, no, I'm actually, I feel like I've been doing that for 4 years during Trump. I feel like I did that for 4 years during George W. Bush. No, I'm trying to have the conversation now. COVID has made it very obvious through the amount of people we've lost that our time is limited. So my goal is to make sure that what time we have left is great.
What would you say to other people who are dealing with the same challenge with their parents or other family members or people who they just care about, believe in conspiracy theories?
I think the best thing for me is asking, just trying to find the commonalities and try to find the common ground. Let's just figure out where we do agree. That's a great starting point. After that, you can start to hopefully break down the walls and the anger and the hate and everything that's been coming with all this stuff to actually maybe have intelligent discussions about the minutia. But it's a really calming experience to talk to people who you've had a problem with for a very long time to find out, you know what, there's a lot of love there. We have a lot of the same ideas. It makes the wild, crazy stuff seem a lot further out there and not as important.
Okay. Thanks for speaking with us.
For sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That was a conversation with our listener from Salt Lake City, Utah. He wanted to remain anonymous. Joining us now are two experts on conspiracy theories. Joan Donovan spends her days tracking conspiracies in the dark corners of the internet. She's the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy. Joan, welcome back to 1A.
Excited to be here.
Also joining us is Ashley Landrum. She's a media psychologist and assistant professor of science communication at Texas Tech University. Ashley, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
We also want to hear from you. Have you ever been convinced to believe in something that turned out not to be true? Or do you also have family and friends who believe in conspiracy theories? How do you deal with all that? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. Ashley, you heard the conversation we just had with our listener in Salt Lake City. What were your takeaways there?
I completely agree with your listener that you need to find common ground with particularly people in your inner circle, you know, family members, really close friends, and have honest discussions about some of these topics, particularly views like QAnon. I mean, these come from extreme distrust in authorities and institutions. People do look for evidence and examples of people not being trustworthy, which is why the listener may have received videos from his father, you know, from Tucker Carlson, you know, just giving examples of situations in which people aren't being trustworthy. And when you don't have a lot of interaction with people from external or outer group members, yeah, you can. It becomes easier to believe the worst about them.
Joan, what about you? What was your reaction to his story?
You know, the way that he was talking about the fear tying into his information seeking really resonates with me as a researcher of misinformation, because I often talk about how you're most vulnerable to misinformation when you know what you don't know. That is, when you're searching for answers and information. And the way that our information ecosystem is set up, once you do take a deep dive on a particular conspiracy theory, the algorithms remember that. And they actually remember how long you were searching for those answers. And they will try to, through reinforcement, bring that topic back up. And so I'm not surprised to hear that he felt like he was almost enveloped by this misinformation.
Well, you got this message from Deb on Facebook who says, conspiracies are a comfort to people who need someone to blame, I guess. Ashley, you're a psychologist. Why do people believe conspiracy theories?
So conspiracy theorizing can actually be a normal, somewhat normal behavior. So when people are confronted with new information, they tend to evaluate that information with regard to their prior views, values, and understandings, these so-called priors. We construct these over the course of our own lifetime from our personal interactions, our experiences, our media diet, et cetera. If information that we're exposed to seems inconsistent or not compatible with our priors, we find ways to dismiss this. And one of the simplest ways of doing that is to question the credibility of the source of that information. And so an example of that, right, is when people use the phrase fake news. Conspiracy theorizing is another way of making sense of information that's not congenial. It didn't make sense to Trump supporters who were consuming media reinforcing his popularity that he would have lost the election. And it didn't really seem to make sense to President Trump either. So they constructed or believed narratives that they found, such as voter fraud, to explain how he could have lost. And then when Trump supporters at home on January 6th saw the insurrection, like what your listener was describing, it didn't make sense to them that people who in some cases would presumably share their views and values, such as respect for law enforcement, would act that way. So they construct or accept narratives that say that those weren't really Trump supporters. So this whole process of the way that we evaluate information is consistent with how we evaluate all information and not just conspiracy theories.
So I think most of us like to think of ourselves as being pretty clear-eyed and able to, you know, sort through information and make, you know, logical conclusions. But as I'm hearing you describe it, it sounds like it would be easy for any of us to fall down a rabbit hole if it supports something we already believe. So what questions should we ask ourselves when we are sorting through information to prevent that from happening?
I think one of the most important is we really need shared values on what's considered credible information or credible media. And for the most part, most people recognize what good sources of information are. I think that the internet, and I'm sure Joan can speak to this too, that there are a lot of different sources of information that people are not familiar with. So there are probably blogs and websites that take names that sound credible, that are probably less than credible. But for the most part, we recognize what credible media is. For other people, especially those who have severe distrust in authorities and institutions, the same criteria that makes something credible for the majority of the population is exactly what makes it not credible. So dismissing experts because you believe that experts have a vested stake in the information that they're presenting. So it's a little bit hard to speak to that group of people who won't trust credible media because the characteristics that make it credible for them make it not credible. But I think for the most part, just, you know, becoming familiar and really kind of trying to gut check and recognize that we're good at being critical of information that's inconsistent with our views, but we're not very good at being critical of information that seems to support it.
We got this message from David, who wrote on Facebook, "A trick I developed is to evaluate claims by switching the subject. For example, if someone says Democrats shouldn't be allowed to vote, I'll mentally replace it with Christians shouldn't be allowed to vote or white people shouldn't be allowed to vote. If it sounds ridiculous or offensive, I consider the message to probably not rise to my ethics." Well, we asked you if you knew anyone who believed in a conspiracy, and quite a few of you told us about your parents.
My dad drove from Utah to the Capitol to protest last week, and he didn't go inside and wasn't part of any of the violence, but he still believes that Antifa were the ones perpetrating the violence and that the Patriots, so to say, were the ones that were doing the right thing. I just find it really unfortunate that he's been misled, and he's read a lot of things online that are fake conspiracy theories about Trump and him actually winning the election. And my dad has never believed in any of these things before, and it's almost like I don't have the same dad when I talk to him. I can't believe the things that he believes, and I personally think that it's Facebook and YouTube who, you know, are letting these conspiracy theories be put out there, and I think it's unfortunate that especially older people are falling for these lies, and I really wish I had my dad back.
Just for quick clarity, Joan, we know that the insurrection at the Capitol was not Antifa, right?
Yes. The same things I think that allowed this situation to play out that brought so many people to the Capitol to in the belief that they were the good guys and that their actions that day to overthrow Congress was the direct result of hearing through so many channels, so much redundancy. That's the same thing that's animating this desire to blame other people, despite the fact that, you know, many of the people that were inside are documented through their own digital traces of, following QAnon conspiracy theories or other anti-state or anti-government conspiracies. And so but you have to understand that there's an entire ecosystem-wide problem online where once you look for this information, there's confirming instances everywhere. And one thing that was really important that happened in the midst of the Capitol siege was that one quote-unquote news outlet put out this story that at least two members of Antifa had been recognized through facial recognition technology, which made people believe that this was happening. But, this idea that there's no trust in this in media is really important because when you get deep into thinking about these conspiracies, what you're also the lens that you're looking through is actually the lens of an adversarial media movement, which is to say that the spaces in which you find QAnon theories are also telling you don't trust the media. And that goes even longer into, for instance, this 4chan anonymous message board who really took media as their target and for years tried to hoax the media and manipulate them into saying the wrong things.
We're discussing conspiracy theories and why people believe them with Joan Donovan, the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy. Also with us, Ashley Landrum. She's a media psychologist and assistant professor of science communication at Texas Tech University. We're also hearing from you. Janet writes on Facebook, "I no longer care what they think or believe. My response to that is to shut them down and walk away. I have no time or patience for anybody living in the Twilight Zone." We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment. Now let's get back to talking about conspiracy theories and why people believe them. We asked you if you've ever believed in one, and here's what a couple of you told us.
My name is Duncan. I'm from San Diego, and I did believe that there was weapons of mass destruction in Iraq when we were told that by the Bush administration.
I'd like to keep my name anonymous. It's hard for me to believe that they put a man on the moon. No other body else has been on the moon. Nobody's been back to the moon. They say they can do it. I don't believe it. I'm sorry. I've never seen any other country on the moon, and we haven't been back. I think it's a bunch of horse malarkey.
Hi, my name is Jack from Superior, Wisconsin. I came to believe that Obama was Muslim, when in fact, I found out later, he wasn't. But the lie had been told often enough, I just came to believe it without checking. And so I'm not surprised that many of Trump's followers believe that there was fraud committed in his reelection.
Thanks to you all for sharing. And there is no evidence of widespread fraud in the 2020 election, which has been confirmed in court cases and by recounts in numerous states. With us to delve deeper into why we believe in conspiracy theories are Joan Donovan, the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy. Also with us, Ashley Landrum. She's a media psychologist and assistant professor of science communication at Texas Tech University. So we got a few questions, Joan, about a man named John Sullivan who was inside the Capitol on January 6th. What should we know about him?
It's a good question. So this is someone who has been going from uprising to uprising in Black Lives Matter and changing his name and his social media handles as he did it. And someone was filming a documentary about him as he was doing this. And essentially what he would do is go from city to city, show up and say, "Here I am. I've arrived. I am your leader," and cause a lot of chaos and really say some inflammatory things. And so within movement organizers of Black Lives Matter, people had been sharing threads online saying, "Don't listen to this man. We don't know what's going on." And there was a very important moment in Utah where someone did fire a gun during a very heated exchange in protest. And so Sullivan is known for this kind of behavior. So he's someone that is what we would say in my world is both an opportunist, but also a nihilist in the sense that he was there, it looks like, for the violence in D.C. And prior to that, even D.C. Black Lives Matter organizers had exiled him from their movement. And we do see this when the propensity for violence is really ratcheted up, is we do see opportunists jump in trying to make themselves known as a key figure. And you can see in the videos as well, he's very much animated by the violence happening.
How did his presence at the insurrection spur some of the conspiracy theories?
Well, because it is there. There's moments in the generation of misinformation where there's evidence everywhere, but nobody really knows how to interpret it. And so the mere fact of his presence and videos of him at Black Lives Matter protests in the past made people draw these conclusions. But then when you look at the reactions to those videos and actually talk to organizers, it's a very different story.
Ashley, are there certain groups of people who are more susceptible to conspiracy theory than others?
So we have done some research on this. There is one challenge to conspiracy theory research, or there has been, and that's the people who are most likely to believe in conspiracy theories are also the least likely to respond to our survey invitations because they don't necessarily want to self-disclose. But I've done some survey work as well as interviews at the Flat Earth International Conference, which is one type of conspiracy. So, you know, we shouldn't necessarily generalize from that. But one thing, sort of one common trait that we've found among conspiracy theorists is this, you know, real desire to think that people are important. It is correlated a bit with religiosity. That's not any specific religion, but just sort of a belief in higher powers, or the belief that things happen for a reason. And I think that, again, this is just correlational work, but that sort of belief that things are designed or that things happen for a reason allows people to sort of construct conspiracies out of certain types of tragedies or things that may not necessarily have a cause behind them.
We got this email from Alan who says 3/4 of Republicans believe Trump won the election. I know they really, really wanted him to win, and the energy of the campaign was impressive. However, the GOP is a major party with millions of members. How can that many people disregard the 50 plus court cases and 80 plus judges who all said that no evidence exists of widespread fraud? Joan, connect the dots for us here. How did we get from people believing that Trump actually won the 2020 election, which he did not, to people violently storming the U.S. Capitol?
So for us as a research team, we really look at patterns of patterns online related to content curation and the way it's distributed. So what's really important here is the concept of performative litigation. John Penny, who's a legal scholar, talks about this. But the point is that people really felt like all legal means of getting the truth, quote unquote, out there had been completely exhausted. I wrote about this in a piece for The Atlantic as well. And when movements believe that every legal or institutional means have completely expired, then they may turn to violence. And I think it's important to think about the 10 minutes around 1 p.m. So you have Trump giving a speech from noon to 1 that said, I'm going with you to the Capitol. And then you have at 1 o'clock, the vote that the vote counting that Pence is overseeing is when people start to storm the Capitol. And Pence had just sent out a letter through social media and other news outlets saying that he was also not going to overthrow or change the certification process. So that moment really matters because you have a networked crowd that are already preparing for action. And they also think that everything that's been done up until then has been systematically rebuffed. And I think that, those legal court cases play a really important role here, because when we think about disinformation campaigns, the problem is how long they go on for, and the redundancy that is. You hear it every day that another court case was turned down. But for many of us, that's just laughable because we knew there was no legal basis. But for many other people, they're saying, well, why aren't they investigating? Why aren't they looking at the evidence? And so that created a perfect storm of misinformation that allowed for that moment to feel as do or die as it did for those that entered into the Capitol.
And meanwhile, the Department of Justice did investigate and found no widespread voter fraud. Ashley, we have to talk about media. Garin wrote on Facebook, the fact that there are media outlets willfully repeating lies and presenting opinions as news doesn't help. And we also got this message from Cobra Donkey, who says, my liberal elderly parents started espousing unusual opinions. When I was visiting, I discovered they had started watching OAN. After a quick Google search, I pointed out that it was Fox on steroids. They were embarrassed they were taken in so easily. You know, we've talked on the show about how online platforms have helped spread conspiracy theories, but what about more mainstream media organizations?
So, you know, as Joan pointed out earlier, social media outlets have the algorithms that feed people confirming evidence based on their prior behavior on the platforms. But people are also really good at doing that by themselves, at sitting in their own echo chambers, at watching news outlets that are going to provide them with sort of information that's consistent with their prior views and values. And so, you know, people might be watching Fox, they're listening to President Trump, they're on social media consuming information that way as well. And they're getting these conspiracy theories or this misinformation or disinformation from these different sources, which also gives them a sense of false consensus, both among sort of their social network or what their group believes, their political group, but also a consensus from whom they view as experts, their congressional leaders, their president, these media outlets. And so if people aren't consuming a variety of different sources, so if they're not watching, like, let's say all three of the sort of top cable news outlets, MSNBC, CNN, and Fox, then they're not seeing all of the different sort of framing and perspectives of the story. And then they're more likely to not even know that some issues are happening around the world, or they're not likely to hear anything that is going to challenge the information that they're getting from Fox or OAN or Newsmax.
We're talking to Ashley Landrum. She's a media psychologist and assistant professor of science communication at Texas Tech University. And Joan Donovan, the director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy. Joan, how essential is that politician piece of this? We had elected officials lying to masses of people.
Yeah, this is for us something that comes up a lot in our research, which is that certain pieces of disinformation are politically advantageous. And so when people are seeing that reinforced in media, and at the same time politicians are too afraid to hold each other to account, and the disinformation serves purposes of getting people in the party excited about them, we often see that opportunity taken by people like Cruz and now Hawley and a few others, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, of course, that is someone who's promoted QAnon conspiracy theories. And so this is the really important aspect of why we need to think about this as a as an ecosystem-wide problem, which is that with Newsmax and OANN, they really took advantage of the moment of the election, especially when Fox had called Arizona and nobody else had for Trump. They really rushed into the breach there to say, well, we're here for the party. We're the news for the party. And as a result, they also had a bunch of Republicans come onto their channel to reinforce those views. And most of them now have to issue retractions, especially as Dominion Voting has come out and started to sue different people related to the false claims. But I do think that if we had Republican politicians that were willing to hold each other to account and didn't get exiled from the party, maybe things would have been very different.
Well, Midnight tweeted, for conspiracy theories, at what point do we look at insecurities and concerns about white relevance or white privilege going away, fueling QAnon and other extremist groups' desires to take over? Joan?
Yeah, this has been at the center of my research for the past several years, even back when I was researching white supremacists and science, which is to say that that fear that the first caller was talking about loss of control, about feeling as if things were moving in a terrible direction, has a lot to do with the ways in which people are seeing the world through the lens of race. And white people are experiencing the rise in attention to the new Black civil rights movement around Black Lives Matter is somehow some kind of status loss, and we need to understand that as a feature of the ways in which white people have always operated to maintain their power and maintain the status quo. And so when you look at the kinds of things people were saying at the Capitol about we're taking our country back, we have to ask, well, from who? And the other piece that a researcher on my team, Brandi Collins-Dexter, is very interested in is thinking about the rallying cry of 1776, counterposed with the notion of 1619, the Pulitzer Prize winning piece from the New York Times about the actual founding of America. And so all of these things together point us back to the fact that we need race analysis and racism analysis to understand the broader problems in our society.
Ashley, we've only got about a minute left here, but Nicole wrote on Facebook, if you figure out how to deprogram them, let me know. My in-laws, especially my brother-in-law, are deep into this. Any guidance for how people can talk to family or friends who believe in conspiracies?
Yeah, so this is definitely a challenge, and I think that there are a lot of different research groups trying to figure out how to do this. I think the sort of the best method so far that people are discovering is really kind of what your listener described, which is really try to increase trust. Don't throw out your family members just because they're holding weird beliefs. You know, keep talking to them, keep building trust, build trust with your friends, your community members, and, you know, hopefully we can learn to trust each other again.
That was Ashley Landrum, media psychologist and assistant professor of science communication at Texas Tech University, and Joan Donovan, director of the Technology and Social Change Research Project at Harvard Kennedy School's Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy. Joan, Ashley, thanks to you both. Remember, we have a text club and we'll only ever send you one text a day. It's the fastest way to connect with us. Details about how to sign up can be found in the Ask 1A tab at the 1A.org. Today's producer was Amanda Williams. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.